from Minsk is visiting his friend Shmerel from Pinsk. Shmerel says to him, "Shabbos morning, we have to go to the synagogue. There's a brand new cantor." So Shabbos morning, Beryl and Shmerel go to the synagogue. And during the service, when it comes time for the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, the cantor puffs himself up and sings. And when he has finished, the entire congregation to a person stands up and screams, "Nochemul, Nochemul, again, again." And so the cantor, even more bold than before, does the repetition of the Shemona Esrei. And when he is finished, the entire congregation once again stands up and screams, "Nochemul, Nochemul," again, again. So he does it a third time, and again, "Nochemul, Nochemul," and a fourth time, "Nochemul, Nochemul." And Beryl turns to Shmerel and he says, "Look, I understand one time. I understand maybe even two, but three times and four times, Nochemul?" "Nochemul Shmochemul," says Shmerel. "He's going to sing it till he gets it right." Hello there. I'm Alan Setcher, and I want to welcome you into Oi, a glimpse into the world of Jewish humor, presented by the Glacier Jewish community of the Flathead Valley, the state of Montana. So I'd like to start out by asking you a question. What's the difference between a shlemiel and a shlemazel? Well, if you have a problem, I'll tell you. A shlemiel is the waiter who spills a large bowl of knedel soup on a patron. The shlemazel is the patron on whom the bowl of knedel soup has been spilled. So here's a proper question. What made a joke Jewish? Well, it had to apply to Jews, but even more so, it had to deal with Jewish sensibilities. You see, just putting a Jewish-sounding name into a joke, that didn't make it Jewish. Or putting Jewish characters or characteristics into a joke, that didn't make it Jewish at all. No. So what do I mean by Jewish sensibilities? Well, I mean those subjects and values that received a disproportionate attention among Jews. That list is long. Let's start with anti-Semitism, which was and is a concern among every Jew. Next is relations with non-Jews. Then there's financial success, or the lack thereof, assimilation. And for sure, we certainly can't forget noshing, that is, food. Critical, of course. And add to our list health and survival. That history, that anxiety, that concern about each and every subject on that list of mine was constant. And how did the Jew deal with those anxieties, with those fears? He dealt by laughing. Four Europeans are trekking through the desert. The heat and the trekking gets to them. So the German says, "I am tired and thirsty. I must have beer." The Brit says, "I am tired and thirsty. I must have tea. The Frenchman says, I am tired and thirsty. I must have wine. And the Jew says, I am tired and thirsty. I must have diabetes. There are plenty of theories to explain Jewish humor. There are tons of books on the market, and most of them written by Jews. Saul Bellow, the author, he thought that Jewish humor combined laughter and trembling. Freud believed that Jewish humor was a defense mechanism, a form of sublimated aggression that lets victims of persecution safely cope with their condition. But I like Mel Brooks's explanation the best. He says, if they're laughing, how can they bludgeon you to death? Your name? Rabinowitz. Wait a minute, Mr. Rabinowitz. You really don't look like you're cut out for this job. Are you sure you're a lumberjack? Yes, I am. It's just that you're such a little man. Well, let's see what you can do. Can you chop down that tree over there? Oh, not bad, Rabinowitz. How about that big one behind it? You can do it in one stroke? This I want to see. Oh, very impressive, Mr. Rabinowitz. Really, I apologize for doubting your ability. I mean, you really don't look like a lumberjack. But you sure can cut trees. Say, where did you learn your trade? Well, for many years, I worked in the Sahara forest. Surely, Rabinowitz, you mean the Sahara Desert. Sure, now it's a desert. Can I share with you a dilemma that I had in preparing this project? Yes, I know quite a few Jewish jokes. My parents knew a lot of Jewish jokes. And my grandparents, it was part of their just about everyday life. But then I began to think, what about my kids? Do my kids know Jewish jokes? Do my kids even understand Jewish jokes? And the answer to that was absolutely not. And I lived in a different world than my parents did. And they lived in a different world than their parents did. Their parents were immigrants. They came from the old country. They came from the shtetl. And their jokes were shtetl jokes. My parents understood those shtetl jokes, and I sort of understood them. But my kids, they have certainly no recollection of the shtetl, nor do they have much of an understanding of the shtetl. Their attitude toward the shtetl is based on having watched or seen or participated in Fiddler on the Roof. And if you watch Fiddler on the Roof, what you do know is that the Jews were more or less happy. They ran around singing. Yeah, they had a bit of poverty, but the poverty wasn't so bad. And they were cute, and they pinched each other on the cheek. And they even got together with the Cossacks and sang and danced in a beer hall with the Cossacks. Oh, yeah? Not on your life. That never, ever would have happened. It was not a great life in the shtetl. It was a terrible life in the shtetl. It was poverty squared. It was misery squared. It was anti-Semitism squared. It was trouble galore. It was a bad, awful life. The Jew lived in danger and anxiety and fear and trembling 24/7. There's a variation on a Shalom Aleichem line in Fiddler that goes like this. Thou hast chosen us, O Lord. Do us a favor and choose someone else. So what was the motor behind the Jewish joke? Well, the motor was the rhythm and the poetry of Yiddish. You see, the Jew could tell a joke in Yiddish because what he knew is that only a Jew would understand it. The peasant around him, they couldn't understand Yiddish. They didn't know it. So the Jew could tell a joke and know that only another Jew would understand. My parents spoke Yiddish. They learned Yiddish from their parents. My parents spoke Yiddish, but they would not speak Yiddish at home. That was not very American. So I really never did learn Yiddish, except for here and there when my parents didn't want my sister and I to understand. My parents would say, Shasha de Kinder. And that much, certainly, I knew. But speaking or even understanding a joke, not at all. Figuring that most of those of you who are listening to this podcast have no experience with Yiddish, let me give you an example from a piece you may know.
Gewein an nigen wie a sod, wo's David hot gespielt vor Gott, nor dir wo's nicht gewein as a Yeshu. Und me singt a zoi, a fan, a soul, a mische berech hebt a kol, der duller meilig webt a halleluja. Deine Mune ist gewollen schwach, der Sheva bot sich auf dem Dach, ihr Chaim, die Levone, dein Refuge. Und sie nimmt dein Guff, sie nimmt dein Kopf, sie schneit von deiner Haare Zopp und zieht von Meul a Robe, Halleluja.
Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, but in Yiddish. My kids and their kids certainly know a number of Yiddish words that have creeped into the English lexicon. Words like yontif, shtick, ganef, kibitzer, schlep, and certainly oi. If I may, I'd like to share with you a personal story about how I learned Yiddish. I'm a student rabbi in California, and I'm assigned to a small hotel for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur out in the Palm Desert. And everybody at the hotel, elderly, they're saying to themselves, a rabbi, of course, every rabbi knows Yiddish. So they would address me in Yiddish, and I didn't want to prove dumb, so I would smile. I would smile and nod my head here and there. One day a woman walked up to me. She opened her purse and she took out a wallet and started showing me a picture. And the picture was of a young man. And I hear her say, "Mein Sohn," and "Rebbe" and "Chazan." Now, I know enough so that I figure "my son" and "rabbi" and "cantor." And I'm nodding my head and nodding my head. And then I hear her say again, "Mein Sohn," and "Rebbe" and "Chazan." And with that, I turned to her and I smiled and I said, "That's wonderful. That's simply wonderful." And she looked at me and her eyes bulged out and she grabbed the wallet and she threw it into her purse and she stormed out. And I turned to the lady standing beside me and I said, "What did I say? What did I say?" She said, "Look, the woman was telling you that her son was planning to be a magnificent rabbi and a superb cantor. And then he met up with a girl that's no good, and she won't let him be a rabbi and a cantor." And I was so embarrassed. And I figured I better learn Yiddish for self-preservation. The following year, while living in Israel, I took a Yiddish course at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem so that I could translate and understand most Yiddish jokes, and even when someone would speak to me, by and large, I could understand them. So in telling a joke in Yiddish, it put the Jew in a world apart, in a private world. The only people who could really understand that joke was another Jew. Let's return to the shtetl. And here is a perfect example of shtetl humor. There is so much contained in this particular story. Motka, well known for his nimble wit, was walking along the street in Petrograd, his mind preoccupied with the Seder over which he was to preside that evening, when he accidentally brushed against the shoulder of a peasant. Snarling, the burly peasant spun around and crashed his fist into Motka's face. But when Motka picked himself up from the gutter, instead of showing anger, he smiled affably and handed the astonished peasant a crisp ruble bill. "Why are you giving me money?" asked the peasant. "Because it is the custom of our people," explained the wily Motka. "Today is Pesach, our Passover, and it is written that an Orthodox Jew must pay a Gentile who strikes him on this holy day." "Well, in that case, I'll hit you again," said the peasant, raising his huge fist. "That won't be necessary. I'm a poor man, and I can't afford to pay you again. But if you go to the mansion of Yudel Opital, the banker, and hit him as hard as you did me, he may give you as much as 100 rubles." The simple-minded peasant grinned. "What a race of fools these Jews are." Straight away, he made for the wealthy Opital's luxurious home, and when the banker opened the door, the peasant gave him a smashing blow to the jaw. Opito fell to the floor, howling and screeching for his servants and his bodyguards. In a moment, the peasant was surrounded by the banker's retainers, who knocked him down, loosened his teeth, blackened his eyes, broke several ribs, and then threw him, half unconscious, into the street. Painfully dragging himself to his feet, he muttered, "That damn Jid had a whole lot of nerve, sending me to a house where they don't even keep their most important holiday." The whole essence of the Jewish situation in the shtetl is right there in Motka's story. To start with, a major problem that existed 24/7 was worrying about the goy. Now, I use the term goy, it's a proper term. It means anybody who wasn't Jewish. It's biblical in nature. A goy is the other nations. The Jew had to worry full time about the goy. He walks down the street, a goy approaches in the other direction. The Jew had to get off the path to make room for the goy coming in the other direction. When the goy approached him, the Jew had to take off his hat. If he accidentally bumped into the non-Jew, he very likely would be struck. The Jew had to worry all the time about all those things happening. So he could tell a joke about it and thus get some sort of relief. But more than that, the Jew had to, at least in his own mind, feel that he was more clever than the non-Jew. And how did he figure that? Mutka's story. Look what I did. I sent the peasant away, and I knew he would get beaten. I knew that would happen if he tried that with a rich man who had bodyguards. But I'm clever. More than that, the Jew always thought he was brighter. And in most cases, he was. He was better educated because from age 4 or so, the Jew went to cheder. The Jew was far more learned than the peasant, but it was the peasant who could turn around and beat him because he had to blame somebody, because the peasant was in as terrible shape as the Jew. The peasant lived in poverty as well. So in telling the joke in Yiddish to another Jew, the Jew is saying, aha, we got the better of him. At least I can get the better of him in a story, even if I can't get it for real. And here's another example. A collector for a Jewish institution in Russia was passing through a forest. And while he was passing through, he was held up by a Cossack who robbed him of all his money. "Let me ask a favor of you," said the collector to the Cossack. "The money you have taken from me belongs to an institution in the next city. When I get there and tell the people I have been robbed, they will refuse to listen to me."
"There is nothing I can do about that," growled the Cossack.
"You can do me a small favor," replied the Jewish collector. "I will hang my hat on a branch of this tree, and you will kindly shoot a hole through it so that they may believe I was actually held up." The Cossack consented and shot 2 holes through the hat. The collector took off his coat and begged the robber to shoot 2 holes through each of the sleeves. Again, the robber did as he was requested. Finally, the Jew took off his vest and asked the robber to make another hole. But the robber said, "No more holes for you, Jew. All my bullets are gone." "That's all I wanted to know," retorted the collector. He leaped upon the Cossack, knocked him down, bloodied his nose, recovered his money, and then tied him hand and foot. The Cossack watched his intended victim depart, and he struggled with his bonds, and he snarled to himself, "Well, that proves it. You simply can't trust a damn Jew." The coping mechanism in full flower. Or how about from Fiddler, the blessing for the Tsar? "May God bless and keep the Tsar far away from here. What helped, too, was the ability to look at everything and laugh. And laugh primarily at yourself. The census taker comes to the Rabinovich house. "Does Abraham Rabinovich live here?" he asks. "No," replies Rabinovich. "Well then, comrade, what is your name?" "Abraham Rabinovich." "Wait a minute. Didn't you just tell me that Rabinovich doesn't live here?" "Aha," says Rabinovich. "You call this living?" Schnorr jokes. Schnorr, that's a beggar. Schnorr jokes abound. It was another way to lighten the load. For instance, we all know the Schnorr joke from Fiddler. The Schnorr who begs for a few kopecks from the Jew, and the Jew says, "I've had a very tough day." And the Schnorr says, "Because you've had a tough day, does that mean I have to suffer?" Or here are two more Schnorr jokes, just so that the Jew could laugh. A Schnorr is used to receiving a set donation from a certain man every week. One day, when he comes for the money, the man tells him that he can't give him anything. "I've had terrible expenses recently. My wife became very sick. I had to send her to a resort in Carlsbad. It's very cold there, so I had to buy her some new clothes and a fur coat." "What?" the beggar yells. "You did all that with my money?" And here's another one. A Schnorr once waggled an appointment with a Rothschild by insisting that he had a foolproof way for the banker to make $500,000. "So let me hear your great idea," said the skeptical Rothschild. "It's very simple," replied the Schnorr. "I understand that when your daughter gets married, you're planning to give her a dowry of $1,000,000. "No." "So I've come to tell you that I'll marry her for half that." Mashiach Zeiten, waiting for the Messiah, was standard. So Tevye and his buddies would sit around frequently over a glass of tea and discuss the world situation. Given the state of their world in the shtetl, their talks were always depressing. But one day, one of the men startles the others by announcing, "You know what? I'm an optimist." The others are shocked. But then one of them notices something very fishy. "Wait a minute. If you're an optimist, why do you look so worried?" "You think it's easy to be an optimist?" "Yeah." The distressed optimist strikes the right chord in much of Jewish humor by insisting that the world is moving toward perfection and that the messianic days lie close to the future. Judaism encouraged Jews to be optimists. But Jewish history, with its tragic record of crusades, expulsions, pogroms, impels the Jews to pessimism. Hence, as Jews then, they were optimists with worried looks on their faces. How about Beryl and Shmerl discussing Torah. Beryl, it's a well-known fact that no pious Jew is permitted to walk about with his head uncovered. And yet, how is it that in our Torah there is no commandment to that effect? Shmerl, you are greatly mistaken, my friend. There are numerous places in the Torah where the sin of going hatless is pointed out to us. Take, for example, the passage in Genesis, which tells us that Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran. Now I ask you, Beryl, can you possibly imagine a Jew like the patriarch Jacob walking all that distance in the hot sun without a hat? So, let's do one last story. We'll change the location of this one from the shtetl to England. It's a tale about a shatchan. A shatchan, a matchmaker. What was the shatchan? Well, the shatchan was J-date for Tevye's daughters. That's the best way to describe it. So, the shatchan comes to Rosenberg and says, Rosenberg, I have a bride for your son. A bride for my son. My son is such a nebbish. My son is overweight. My son has no profession. My son is not very learned. And you have a bride? Well, tell me. The bride is Princess Anne. Are you crazy, Princess Anne? No. Princess Anne will be so captivated by the charm of your son that she will instantly want to marry him. But I just said, my son has no livelihood. He has no money. I'm just a clerk in a grocery store. But Princess Anne will fall so in love with your son that she will gladly give all her wealth to the marriage. But my son knows nothing. It doesn't matter. Princess Anne, who has superb knowledge, will so want to teach your son that this will make a spectacular shidduch. But Princess Anne is Church of England, and my son is Jewish. How is that even possible? Princess Anne will be so absolutely in love with your son that she will gladly convert to Judaism. Are you sure Princess Anne would be willing to marry my son, who has nothing, who has no profession, who has no knowledge, who has no personality? She would be willing to marry my son? Of course, she will be so in love with your son, she will be eager to marry your son. Well then, make the match. So, the shatchan leaves the Rosenberg home, and as he's walking out the door, he turns to his assistant and he says, well, that's half the battle. Thus, we draw to a close episode 1 of Oi, a glimpse into the world of Jewish humor. And we owe a good deal of thanks to a number of people. let's start with our authors, William Novak and Moshe Waldox, Joseph Telushkin, Ruth Weiss, Henry Spaulding, and to Daniel Kahn for the Yiddish version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. And our thanks as well to Rabbi Francine Rosten, to Catherine Lay, to Mike Eldred, and to David Pickerel. Episode 2 will be Jewish humor in the Western world. Future episodes will be the world of Sholem Aleichem, Yehuda Leib Peretz, I.B. Singer, and a number of other Yiddish writers, and then for sure, Jewish comedians. It's been fun. I've enjoyed doing it. I'm Alan Setcher, and I wish you a big azint. Stay safe, stay well.